From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. The holidays are a time for family and food.
It's time to cook the final dishes and make the finishing touches. First, I'm getting Mum to help cook my chili and turmeric roasted potatoes. This dish is another twist on tradition. It gives the potatoes a lovely colour, and their spicy kick helps complement and lift the whole Christmas meal.
Chef Christopher Kimball of Milk Street joins us later this hour to talk about all things kitchen. And we'd love to hear from you. What are some of your favorite holiday recipes? Which holiday, by the way, has the best menu? Give us a call and leave a message, 404-500-9457. You can also post to Facebook or Twitter. We're at OSD Talk. And remember, we might feature your comments on the show. This is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. Colin Mochrie may have one of the fastest minds around. The comedian is best known for his role on Whose Line Is It Anyway? And what you might call hair trigger humor. Colin joined us in the studio.
When did you first suspect you might be good at improv? Like, when did you first think, hey, this is my niche?
Oh, well, there wasn't a time. When I was growing up, it didn't exist. So it wasn't until I first saw improv, some friends were demonstrating it. I thought, oh, this would be interesting to try out. You don't really have to learn anything. You just make up crap. I can do that. And I took a workshop and found that I really had an affinity for it. And so it just became something I loved doing. And I never thought, oh, this is going to be my career. So it's really worked out nicely for me.
I mean, obviously, you have to practice and rehearse improv quite a lot, which seems antithetical, but it's not. But do you think an improvisation pro is born or made?
Oh, well, I think anyone can do improv. I mean, all our lives are improvised. So basically, the two rules are doing the things that we don't do in real life, which is listening and accepting other people's ideas. That is the hardest hurdle for new improvisers to get over. There's that thing, and that's where, no, my idea is better. And once you learn to let that go, you can be a good improviser. I think the humor aspect, I think you're born with it. I don't think anyone... classes could make you funnier. They can't make you funny. You have to have that, I think, to begin with.
Let's hear from the late comic Del Close. He's often called the father of long-form improv. He played a big role in forming Second City. Here he is speaking in 1970. He's talking to the legendary journalist Studs Terkel and explaining why he thinks improv is more than just sketch comedy.
The theater of psychology, the theater of feeling, is very much on the way out. And it's only through action that we understand someone, not through what they tell us about themselves. No soliloquy is going to reveal nearly so much about what the guy does as what he does after the soliloquy, what the guy's like, rather. And that's what I'm trying to get to in improvisation as well.
So how do you, when you're practicing improv, how do you balance the verbal, what you're saying, and you're so good at the one-liners, right, mm-hmm. with the physicality that he's talking about?
You know, it all depends on the scene. You know, I don't really practice improv. What I do is try to get to a state where I'm just totally relaxed on walking out onto a stage in front of an audience who have paid good money to see a show that I don't have at that moment. So you're open to everything that comes along. And then your body and mind go into sort of a survival mode where you start physicalizing even the smallest moment can get a laugh and get an audience to go, I know that movement. I know that person. I know that situation. It just becomes an organic thing that you and your partners sort of start to breathe together and make this living scene. It's such a bizarre art form because it truly just lasts for that moment. If you saw someone say, you know, I saw this really funny show last night, the guy walked like a duck. And you go, well, what? You had to be there to see the entire process and why that was funny at that moment. It really is such a, it's like a firefly or something. It just lives for that 2 hours and then it's gone forever.
Although there are people who watch reruns of Whose Line Is It Anyway endlessly, here's a pretty popular sketch. One of the sketches that you did numerous times on that show was where you played a news anchor, and each time you had a different name. Here are a few of those names.
Welcome to the 6 o'clock news. I'm your anchor, Arthur Any More Donuts. Welcome to the 6 o'clock news. I'm your anchor, Earl from Ipanema. Welcome to the 6 o'clock news. I'm your anchor, Wolverine St. Jack John. Welcome to the 6 o'clock news. I'm your anchor, Lars of the Red Hot Lovers.
You shook your head.
It's just sad when you hear them all in a row. Oh, the career is gone now.
I mean, do you often go back and listen to improvisation or sketches that you've done?
No. There are times where I'll be, you know, clicking channels and I'll see a Who's Line and watch it. And it's I'm watching as an audience because I have no memory of that particular scene. The only one, and now I don't know if I know it because I remember, or I've just seen it so many times, is the Richard Simmons scene where I use him as a jet ski that... Yet to be there.
Well, actually, we have a little clip of that also. We first hear Drew Carey introducing everyone.
Let's continue the show with a game called, I love this game, Living Scenery. This is for Ryan, Colin, and Wayne. And Richard Simmons, everybody. Richard Simmons. Ryan and Colin are going to act out a scene. During the scene, they have to use a number of props. However, since they don't have any real props to work with
I'll
tonight,
be the prop.
Right, Wayne and Richard.
He was so committed.
Yes.
You've got to love that.
What makes a good partner in improv? I mean, you've already said somebody who listens and responds, right? Mm-hmm. Is that basically all that you need?
That's it. And trust, someone that you totally trust. You know, I work with Ryan Stiles a lot, and I tour with Brad Sherwood. Both those guys, I usually know where they're going to go in a scene. But when I don't, I trust them both enough to just follow along and see what's going to happen. So trust is a big part.
So when you're doing improv, I mean, improv, I assume, is a relative, based on whatever shows I've been to, they seem to be a relatively diverse crowd of, mm-hmm. of people. And I wonder how you deal then with controversial subjects, or if you steer away from them. It's hard these days because almost everything becomes political, right?
Yeah.
But do you hesitate before you bring up a joke or a line that might be controversial?
We try. Brad Sherwood and I have been touring for 15 years. And lately, we've actually started off the show saying, we would like to keep this a political-free show. We're just doing goofy stuff. So please, let's not mention just the current events. Because I don't know, in an improv setting, we can... bring justice to what the suggestion is. You know, there are so many great satirical, political satirists out there who can make a point. Our thing would be, well, this is stupid. And then it'd be hard to sort of build on that. And it's not what we do. We're just there to have goofy fun. We throw little things out. But we started to notice during the Bush administration, there was one night Brad made a totally innocuous Bush joke, and the audience was immediately divided in half. And it was like, wow, how did this happen? Americans love making fun of their presidents. And it's just gotten actually worse since then. So we made this choice, just let's keep away from it. It's not what our show is mainly about. And it's really not worth it for that one little moment to suddenly split up our audience.
And that's very different. That's a clear dividing line between how vocal you may or may not be in your personal life as opposed to what you do on stage. And that's especially true. You've been quite public in support of your transgender daughter. In January, you tweeted, quote, "My 90-year-old mother-in-law and 87-year-old mother love and acceptance of our trans daughter warms me. Wonder why some who are younger can't," end quote. So here's an actual comment from the CBC, an interview of your daughter, Kinley, talking about her transition.
I had come out to my mom. My dad was out of town, and it was a lot of conversations, getting all the information, making sure we were on even playing field. It took some time, but I knew that support and acceptance was on the other side. I was not worried for a second.
How do you separate those kind of things? And obviously, transgender issues are very much in the political and public eye, extremely controversial. So how do you successfully keep those separate?
It's just something I've done. I've always sort of kept my professional and private life separate. I mean, except for the fact that I'm known from television, I think people would be surprised if they didn't know me that I was in the entertainment business because I'm very quiet. I'm very shy. I tend to listen more than actually start conversations. So I always kept those two things. My wife calls the guy on Whose Line the other, because it is nothing like the man she has married, which is great because I think that would be very tiring to be married to someone who is on all the time. So that's a totally separate issue. And my private life, transgender politics is something I've obviously become involved in lately because of personal experience. And just, you know, it's 2017. I've missed a year. I really feel we should be in the Star Trek part of our life where everyone has gotten together, we're all doing fine, and now we're heading off into find other worlds to screw up and keep this one good. I think it's ridiculous that we still have to work on gender and race and sexual politics at this time where we have so much information. Maybe we have too much information. It's hard for people to sort of figure out what the truth is and what is just stuff that's thrown out there. So when I do talk about it, it is from my personal life and something I feel very passionate about. And, you know, I'm not going to change a lot of people's perceptions about this, but if I can get a conversation starting, you know, that's a beginning.
In the 30 seconds that we have left, what is the role then for comedy in a time when even a joke divides people?
I think, you know, people like Stephen Colbert and Seth Meyers and John Oliver, we need those guys because they're showing the idiocy of the world, of the government, of the people who are in power. And we need that to sort of keep them honest as much as we can. You know, I don't think a comedy show can completely save the world, but it can get people thinking and get them out there and make them want a better world, a world where we can laugh maybe about other things at some point, where, you know, the biggest joke will be about a puppy.
As comedian and king of improv, Colin Mockery. Just ahead, breaking down a classic New Year's Eve anthem. But first, a conversation about cooking with a man behind Milk Street. This is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. This is On Second Thought. We first met Chef Christopher Kimball in America's Test Kitchen on TV and in the pages of Cook's Illustrated.
And we cooked it with the butter until it starts to set. Put the top on, let it sit for a minute. Then we have to put it back on the heat for 20 seconds.
That's right.
Turn it out, use the napkin rolling technique. Have I left anything out
That's
here?
That's it.
Last year, he launched a new project, Milk Street. The Boston-based venture teaches cooking, produces a TV show, and publishes a magazine.
So, Chris, you can see our sauce is cooked down. It's been about 5 minutes, and the color's also changed to this deep, beautiful emerald green.
You know, I had a small pond in Vermont once that looked just like that. It was kind of stagnant, you know.
But did you taste it?
No, I didn't. Even the cows wouldn't drink out of it.
We spoke with Christopher Kimball earlier this year.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing well. You know, I've always wondered, because I mean, I'm a kind of a fangirl. I probably have seen you for years and years and years and own every single thing, including Milk Street that you've published. What is the most you've ever had to make of a recipe? I mean, sometimes they describe, you guys have described making dozens of batches of things. What was the toughest?
Well, this would be at America's Test Kitchen. Years ago, we did a chocolate cake 130 times, I think.
Holy cow.
Which is insane. I mean, yeah. I'm now reformed. I'm like, I'm going to recipe testing anonymous. Now we will keep it down to 10 or 12 times probably now. And our philosophy now is that we spend a lot of time on the front end figuring out what we want to test and what's really important. So I've gotten away from the 100 tests, but you still have to make it more than 3 or 4 times.
Yeah, and a lot of that, when you talk about figuring out on the front end, does that mean you're sort of figuring out scientifically how it might work before you even crack open a bag of flour?
Well, I think what it means is you're very clear about what you're after before you get into the testing. Sometimes tests take a turn, you know, an unexpected turn, but you're very clear about what you want out of a recipe before you start. You know, it's like the old Vermont expression, if you don't know where you're going, you can take any road, it'll get you there, you know? So you want to be really careful where you're trying to head up. I think also, if you're trying to do recipes that people are familiar with, like a chocolate chip cookie or an apple pie or whatever, then, you know, you're trying to perfect it to get the best version of that thing. What we're doing now is very different, which is we're going around the world and trying to put together a sort of a new repertoire. So it's less a question of perfecting something people are already familiar with. We're introducing something new. So it's a little different in terms of what we're testing for.
Is there a particular either ingredient or type of recipe that you know is usually going to be problematic for a home cook? Like I would assume maybe dough, because it's so difficult
yes.
to keep the yeast at the right temperature and keep it alive, et cetera, et cetera. Is that the most tricky thing?
Pie dough probably is the hardest thing because you have to cut the fat into the flour just right and use just amount the right amount of liquid. And if it's too dry, it falls apart. If it's too wet, it turns out bakes up tough. Yes, dough. We just did a piece in the new issue on pizza dough. And it turns out the most important factor in pizza dough is the temperature of the dough before you shape it and bake it off. And if it's 75 degrees, it's malleable, it'll bubble up, it'll be chewy. If it's 65 degrees or 68 degrees, it won't be. So that's something that people don't realize is the temperature of the dough, not just how
while
much water is in it. No.
While
it's rising too, because if it's going to be 65 degrees, it's going to take a long time to rise. But before you pre-shape it into the four balls, if you're making that kind of recipe, you can let it sit in the fridge for a day if you want to develop flavor. You don't have to. Then you let it rise. Yeah, you want it rise in a warm place. But before you actually start to shape the dough into a pizza, you want to make sure that dough is around 75 degrees. If it's too cool, it'll be hard to shape, and it won't bake up right. It won't bubble up. It'll be a little tough. So the texture and the flavor of it will be much better, and it's easier to work with. So temperature, it turns out, is the most important thing in pizza.
What keeps you in this business? I mean, essentially, for decades now, you have been teaching people, and the recipes are so precise that even somebody with almost no experience in the kitchen could successfully make your chocolate chip cookie, right? What keeps you doing that?
No one's ever asked me that before. That's a good question. What else am I going to do? I can't go rabbit hunting every day or grow potatoes. I love what I do. I mean, look, what a great business. I mean, you sit down, you have a kitchen, you have people testing recipes, you argue about recipes, you taste recipes, you do a TV show, you do a radio show. I mean, you do a magazine. It's just really fun. And I'd say in the last few years, what keeps me going now is I've completely changed how I cook. I mean, it's a totally different ball game. I cook a lot more than I have in years, and I'm back at the beginning of the learning curve, really.
So what has kind of gone wrong, I guess, in our kitchens across America? Because with all of the time-saving appliances we now have, all the different things that make it so much easier to cook now than, say, my grandmother did, why do so few people actually cook their own dinners?
A lot of reasons. It started in the 70s and 80s when women came into the marketplace in large numbers, as they should have. which meant there was fewer people at home. Two, the alternatives are there. There's Blue Apron, you know, there's prepared foods at Whole Foods markets and other places, a lot of restaurants versus 20, 30 years ago. So you have lots of alternatives to cooking your own food. And I think the biggest problem was people viewed, and this goes back to the 19th century, the 1880s actually, people viewed cooking as a necessary evil to get food on the table. And when you view it as a chore, not a pleasure, you try to avoid it. What's happened in the last 10 or 15 years is I think we're redefining what cooking is. It's not a chore. It's actually pleasurable. And once you get to the point that you enjoy it, then it's something you'll do more of. But for all those reasons, it's just a different place than it was in when Fanny Farmer wrote her cookbook in 1896, when there just weren't that many choices.
So how do you go about, when you go about writing a recipe down for other people? You know, I've read cookbooks that for me, I'm just a cook. I'm not a chef. So when I sometimes read, say, Jamie Oliver, and he says, add a dash of whatever. And I'm like, I don't know what a dash is, which is one of the reasons that I loved America's Test Kitchen, why I really like Milk Street, because it tells me exactly how much. How do you, what decisions do you have to make when you're actually writing a recipe down for someone else to recreate?
Well, yeah, I've made my career based on the huge difference between how people actually cook at home and how people think people cook at home. It's a different world. People will leave out entire steps. They'll substitute ingredients wildly. My favorite was someone substituted shrimp for chicken once, you know, in a recipe and came out tough, oddly enough. People do all sorts of crazy things. And I think in part because they don't want to follow a recipe. They want to improvise. They want to be artistic. And so they feel it's beneath them to do what the recipe says. And I always say, the first time you make a recipe, please follow it step by step. But if you've been doing this a long time, they're just things you know people are going to do. For example, they'll substitute one cut of meat for another. That happens all the time. Or they'll substitute chicken breast for chicken thighs, which completely changes everything. Or they may not have a particular kind of ingredient, so they'll put something else in. Or their oven's off 40 degrees or 50 degrees from what they think. And so if you say bake for 40 minutes, that's useless. You know, what you do is say bake for 20 minutes, open the oven, turn it around, look at it, check it every 3 or 4 minutes after that. So there's some things that you see over time that reoccur, and you just want to make sure that people are paying attention to that.
And has that job changed? And I say that because in my grandmother's day, she could read cookbooks that didn't have a lot of instruction because she had been educated in the kitchen. I wasn't. Yeah. So they say, you know, look for shiny sauce, and I don't know what shiny looks like. Does that mean you have to be more instructive?
Yes, it does. If you pick up the original Fanny Farmer, they have replica copies you can buy. If it's to make a pie pastry, she used three words: make a paste. Period. Paste was a pie dough. That's all she said because everyone knew how to do it because they made it 3 times a week. Now, if I were to describe how to make pie pastry, it would take me 300 or 400 words because you have to talk about the butter and the Crisco and how cold it should be and how big the pieces should be, and how to describe how far to cut the fat into the flour using a food processor or using your hands, and what should the color of the flour look like, and what should it feel like, and how much water to add and how not to add too much. And yes, so you have to go into a lot more detail.
So tell me about a surprise that you had. You know, I have used for a long time the America Test Kitchen recipe that puts vodka in the pie crust to make dry and flaky, which is a revelation to me.
It's a great recipe.
Yeah. What kind of surprises have you had in the kitchen where you either added an ingredient or changed something that you would have never expected?
Well, at Milk Street, I've had to unlearn a lot of things I thought were true. For example, I don't use store-bought stock hardly at all, because if you cook a chicken or a piece of beef in water, you create your own stock. And that's a very French tradition, which really... there are times you use stock, but most of the time you don't need to. I don't saute meat, you know, before I make a stew or a soup, for example, because you have meat. I don't need to double down on the umami flavor. I want the other flavors to come through. Otto Lenghi introduced me to this, which is using handfuls of herbs, right? Like 2 cups of cilantro or 2 cups of parsley or 1 cup of basil or dill. Massive quantities of things like that, you know, spices. Most of the cooking in Northern Europe barely use spices. French cooking doesn't use spices hardly at all. Places in the Middle East will use 3 tablespoons of sumac, you know, or 2 tablespoons of cumin. I mean, so all the rules I grew up with, which are mostly English and French, some of that stuff still makes sense, but some of it doesn't. In other words, there are very different ways of thinking about what cooking is in different places in the world. And so I've had to sort of let that go, you know, and sort of clear out my head and take a fresh look, because there are other ways of thinking, entirely different ways of thinking about what is cooking and what is food and what is dinner.
How different are these recipes? Well, let me put it another way. How much can somebody who just does not have the equipment that you have follow the recipes in Milk Street? Do you need a set of French sauté pans to be able to...
No. I mean, don't forget, most people in the world don't have much equipment. I mean, a lot of places in the world, they don't even have ovens in their kitchen, like Vietnam. You know, they just have stovetops. Or Thailand, same thing. They have a propane burner or two. So the French had more, you know, batterie de cuisine cookware than anybody. So if you go anywhere else in the world, you're dealing with much, you know, many fewer things and not expensive things. So no, 85% or 90% of the recipes in Milk Street don't call for things that are hard to find. We occasionally will, like sumac is a, it's a berry. It's was used as a lemon in the Middle East, really a sort of sour and fresh tasting. And there are recipes that, where it's all about the sumac, so we'll call for that. But 85-90% of the time, these are things that you either have at home or can get easily in your local supermarket. So it's not about exotica. I mean, when I was learning to cook in the 60s and 70s, you know, there was ethnic cooking, a term I don't love, but it was about authentically preparing a dish from Oaxaca, you know, a mole sauce, and it took all day, and this and the other thing. Well, that's not what's going on now. Everyone's talking about home cooking, Tuesday night cooking. And so there's simplicity to all of this. And all cultures, you know, have the same approach. They're not going to spend all day cooking dinner on a Wednesday night. So simplicity is really at the core of all of this. And whereas French cooking, I think, to a large extent, is not about sometimes, but is not about simplicity.
So what effects do you think has the changes in cooking habits had on greater society? I mean, you must have thought about this a bit, the connection, say, between the obesity epidemic and, fast food or not cooking at home. How has our either propensity to cook our own meals or not cook our meals affected our lives, the quality of our lives?
Well, the two separate things. There's the whole fast food phenomenon, which is terrible with adult onset diabetes and the sodas and everything else and supersize me. That's a problem. I think one reason I'm such a proselytizer for home cooking is it's very hard to make yourself sick cooking at home, you know, because it's inherently healthier because you're cooking from scratch most of the time. I do think, though, that most of the world starts with big flavor ingredients, chilies, spices, herbs, ginger, scallions, fish sauce, soy sauce, etc. You can get big flavors at home now pretty easily, whereas that's not true in French cooking. French cooking starts with fairly mild ingredients and then over a period of time develops flavor. That can give people what they want. People want big flavor. They always have. And so that's why they go to fast food, right? It's full of fat, it's full of salt, it's full of big flavors. You can get that at home now without more time and effort because all the stuff's available and we're cooking differently. And everyone knows, people go out to restaurants. They know people can go to a Tibetan restaurant in the middle of Pennsylvania, Lancaster, Pennsylvania, for example. So that gives me some hope that people can get what they really want fairly quickly and easily. You know, maybe that will offset to some degree this rush to fast foods that occurred in the 80s, 70s, 80s, and 90s.
So what do people see at the live show version of Milk Street, as opposed to watching the TV show?
I see me make a complete fool of myself, which, of course, is always entertaining. And I'm very good at that. I figured out a couple years ago that a live event's about the audience and the person on the stage and interaction. So, you know, I'm not there to lecture anybody. I'm there to bring people up on stage to do a tasting or a cook-off or a quiz or have some fun, a lot of Q&A. You know, we're there. If anybody, you know, two people cook, you know, they have something in common. And so I have something in common with everybody who comes to the show. And we're just not there to have fun, you know. And I like to make fun of the audience, you know, some of the stupid things they do in the kitchen. And then they get to make fun of me. So that's what it is. It's that back and forth. And that's what makes a fun evening for me anyway.
That's Chris Kimball, cook, TV and radio personality and founder of Christopher Kimball's Milk Street. Just ahead, the origins of that song no one seems to know the words to, Auld Lang Syne. This is On Second Thought.
Back in the day, we were out of
It's On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. Sports protests have made major news this year. In September, President Trump went on record disparaging professional football players for kneeling during the national anthem. The president's comments seemed to inspire more players to take a knee. The Atlanta Falcons were among many others who locked arms during the anthem to protest racial injustice. 50 years ago, two athletes brought this kind of silent protest to the Olympic medal podium. Track stars Tommy Smith and John Carlos raised their fists in a Black Power salute during the ceremony. We spoke with Tommy Smith last year after he and John Carlos were honored by President Barack Obama.
I wanted to actually play a comment to get our conversation started. From John Carlos, and I asked him about higher paid athletes like Serena Williams becoming more politically active, and then some cautioning that, say, for example, Serena could hurt her career and hurt her earnings if she starts speaking out on political issues. And here's what John Carlos said about that.
It's not about the money. That's what Mr. Kaepernick is saying right now. You know, when I made my statement 28, 48 years ago, I had $13 in my bank account. This young man had $13 million in his account. He's showing the rest of the athletes, this is not about how much money you have or how much money you don't have. You know, Serena, I'm sure she will survive if they took the endorsements away from her. I'm sure Mr. Kaepernick will survive if they took the endorsements away from her. If they feel that, you know, that they're going to move her away from endorsements because she chose to stand up for what's right in society, I don't need those products anyway, if that's the attitude those individuals have, because it makes me think maybe behind closed doors, those sponsors might have a different view about how society should be run.
So let me ask you about that, Tommy Smith. Did it run through your mind at all how your message back in 1968 might affect your career, your earnings, your future?
Well, you know, it depends on the individual. John Carlos was talking about it. It depends on the individual how one might view any type of involvement such as this. It was a needed thing to do, and we did it from a college perspective and not a financial perspective. I had no career. I had no education. My sacrifice was a little bit different than both people who have money. So it depends on the individual. You can't take a Serena and put her in the same category as Tommy Smith. You can't take Kaepernick and put him in the same category as John Carlos. These are individual moves that the participants have. So don't put me in the same package as you put someone else who does the same thing. We have different ideas about what we're doing. As long as it's nonviolent, as long as it pertains to the system, as long as it pertains to inequality or policing and nonviolent change, I think the conversation should be around what one think about it themselves and not categorize it with a group of people who are doing something very similar.
Now, the Kaepernick we're referring to is San Francisco 49ers quarterback Colin Kaepernick. He continues his protest. He continues to kneel during the national anthem before games. And he told reporters his purpose is to bring greater attention to the issue of police violence and social injustice.
There's people being murdered unjustly and not being held accountable. Cops are getting paid leave for killing people. That's not right. I'll continue to sit. I'm going to continue to stand with the people that are being oppressed. To me, this is something that has to change. And when there's significant change, and I feel like that flag represents what it's supposed to represent, and this country is representing people the way that it's supposed to, I'll stand.
So without putting the both of you in the same category, Tommy, there is a similarity to the symbolism of your action and then that of Colin Kaepernick. Well, yours was on a world stage. Yeah, so when something is a symbolic gesture, what is the effectiveness of this? How effective can a gesture like that be?
But in 68, we had a platform of South Africa, Rhodesia, more coaches, more African-American or coaches of color hired, housing. We had things that were identifying to the college campus and the human rights issue.
If you're just joining us, my guest is former Olympic athlete Tommy Smith, who won the gold medal in the 1968 Olympics in Mexico City. So we got this tweet from a listener. Question, where does activism belong? Bart tweets, answer, nowhere. So it has to belong exactly where it doesn't belong. That's what makes it activism. And this is something that I brought up with John Carlos as well. In response to the people who say Colin Kaepernick is an athlete and he needs to focus on his sport and quit making political statements, here's what Giancarlo said.
John, that's a stupid statement. That's a stupid statement. That's the same stupid-ass statement that they made 48 years ago. How do you tell an individual that you are suspended from society because you're an athlete, that you shouldn't have any concerns about the well-being of those individuals that you grew up with in your community? That's like telling a minister he's not supposed to go to church on Sunday.
So how do you feel about this particular issue? Those who are saying Colin Kaepernick's being paid for a job and kneeling during the national anthem or making a political protest is not part of that job.
Let's continue where John left off. I think it's a comment the individual called in is just as bad as the decision the 1968 that the president of the IOC made about John Carlos and Tommy Smith, saying that movements like Carlos and Smith has no place in the Olympic movement. But in 1936, he was in justice or in favor of being ruled or moved like the SS of Hitler. I think people in any position, even Colin Kaepernick, has a right to voice his opinion in this particular flow of life. Now, it's hard because some people, just like I did a few minutes ago, stumble over a need to identify specifically. There's no specifics about what Colin Kaepernick has or have not delved in before he did this. Yes, he has a concern. He used the only platform that he knew how, or the only platform that he had was to voice his opinion. And I think anyone who says that play your sports and let everything else go, they take the humanistic point out of that person's life.
Do you feel as though your protest ended up impacting your future and your career? Do you think it changed the course of your life?
Well, I had not lived that life before. So I can only say that what I viewed, I believe it had a tendency to make people view me negatively because it had never been done before. And the ideal cause of why it was done was the same reason those people decided to call in and refute the physical movement that John Carlos and Tommy Smith had, because they knew either.
So let me play you one more comment that your former colleague John Carlos said. And this is when I was asking about whether or not athletes, because of their position, are obliged to stand up for what they think is injustice. And here was his response.
How you trying to do? They have obligation when they can wait until their mama get hit or across the head or get killed because they came to the wrong house. You darn tootin', they have obligation, you know. And for individuals such as Shaq and Jerry Rice changed his mind. But I see all of the naysayers out there. And the question is, down the line, how are they going to come out in history? Which side of the road are they going to be classified on that day?
What do you think about that, whether or not athletes are obliged to use the position they've been given to speak out?
It's their position. They fought for that position. They can do what they feel is necessary while they're in that position. And I do think it's a necessity for athletes, especially athletes, who have a world stage to proactively move in a direction to make a nation stronger. There are those who say what we did is freedom enough. I don't believe freedom comes in what other people say about what I just did. I, constitutionally speaking, that's where the freedom is, and it is written. And if one doesn't get it, it is written in the Constitution to say one must lobby to change it.
Former Olympic gold medal winner Tommy Smith, he now lives in Georgia. He and fellow Olympian John Carlos sparked an international debate after they raised their fists during the 1968 medal ceremony. It's almost that time of year when people stay up until midnight, and when the clock strikes, they sing that song no one knows the words to.
For old lang syne, dear, for old...
That's a version of Auld Lang Syne performed by Scottish singer Susan Boyle. The song is based on a Scottish poem written more than 200 years ago. So what does it mean, and why is it connected to New Year's? If it's something we all say but don't really understand, then it's a good time to break it down. Let's start with the meaning of the words, Auld Lang Syne. We're talking about Old Scottish here, and it's really hard to find a real equivalent in English. Auld Lang Syne roughly translates to old long since, or times gone by.
Play it once, Sam. For all time's sake, play as time goes by.
Well, I can't remember it myself. I'm a little rusty on it.
Right sentiment, wrong song. When you sing For Auld Lang Syne, you're saying for the sake of old times. That's why you should never sing For the Sake of Auld Lang Syne, because that's like saying for the sake of old times. Get it?
I don't understand. Isn't that just the saddest thing you ever heard?
The first known use of the phrase dates back to the 1500s. But that's not the version we know. Our version comes from Robert Burns, the national poet of Scotland. Toward the end of his life, Burns became really interested in folk music and traditional songs. He found the lyrics to Auld Lang Syne and sent them to someone at the Scottish Musical Museum. He included a note that said,
"The following song, an old song of the olden times, and which has never been in print, nor even in manuscript until I took it down from an old man."
The tune we all sing isn't the one Robert Burns used either. The original tune, so we're told, sounded like this. Here's Scottish singer and musician Davy Lees performing it for us.
Should all the acquaintance be forgot and never brought to mind? Should all the acquaintance and Auld Lang Syne.
It's a beautiful melody, but it's not the one most of us sing at 12:01 on January 1st. Why did the tunes get changed and when? No idea. But I can answer that question about what the song means. The fact is, Auld Lang Syne was never intended to be a New Year's song or even a holiday song. It really just says, we should remember old friends and the good things they've done. And it calls for a toast, that cup of kindness. In fact, in true Scottish tradition, it mentions having a drink no less than 8 times.
It is time for some more drinking games. These are some games we play near some drinking.
Now, before we leave the history behind, here's a fun fact about Robert Burns. He's so beloved in Scotland that in 2009 he won a vote for the greatest Scot of all time, narrowly beating William Wallace.
Tell our enemies that they may take our lives, but they'll never take our freedom!
And David Tennant of Doctor Who fame.
I'm sitting in the TARDIS now, and I'm going to wind up soon, but not before I make a few strange noises with my mouth that will go somewhere along the lines of bingle bongle, dingle dangle, yickety doo, yickety da, ping pong, lippy tappy too ta.
Sean Connery didn't even make the top 10.
Do you expect me to talk? No, Mr. Bond, I expect you to die.
Anyway, back to Auld Lang Syne. The final question we need to answer is this. Why do we sing it on New Year's?
What does this song mean? My whole life, I don't know what this song means.
I mean, should old acquaintance be forgotten? Does that mean that we should forget old acquaintances? It doesn't mean that if we happen to forget them, we should remember them, which is not possible because we already forgot them.
Well, maybe it just means that we should remember that we forgot them or something. Anyway, it's about old friends.
In Scotland, New Year's Eve is a friendly event called Hogmanay. That's the day when some Scots swing balls of fire around, sprinkle water all over their houses, and give gifts to tall, dark men who enter their houses soon after midnight. They also cross their arms across their chests, link hands, and sing Auld Lang Syne. The tradition of singing that song spread fairly quickly all over the British Isles, and if some experts are to be believed, it was bandleader Guy Lombardo that made it popular in the U.S.
Yes, sir, Happy New Year, gang. This is Guy Lombardo adding the musical postscript to your Swing Around the Clock.
Guy Lombardo was the Dick Clark of his time. He and his band rang in the new year for millions of Americans for almost 50 years. Back in 1929, he used Auld Lang Syne as filler music during a New Year's radio broadcast at the Roosevelt Hotel in New York, and the tradition caught on. It is now a worldwide phenomenon. In Japan, stores play it to let customers know that it's closing time. And in China, it's so widely played that many people think it's an old Chinese folk tune. It is not. It's even made its way onto the pop charts in some places. This song, Poor Jim, was a hit for the Danish band Gasolin. In 1997, as Hong Kong prepared to move from English rule to Chinese, the pipers of the Royal Hong Kong Police Force played Auld Lang Syne as the last British governor left his official residence.
And the tune of Auld Lang Syne being played now by the police band. Yet another traditional Scottish tune to say farewell.
So the song has come a long way from that old man who once sang it for Robert Burns back in the 1700s, but most people still don't know the words. So we're going to help you out with that. We've posted the lyrics at our Facebook page. And that's our show for today, but let's hear from you. Which holiday has the best music? Maybe you like spooky tunes of Halloween. Maybe you love Christmas carols. Let us know which holiday has the best soundtrack. Give us a call at 404-500-9457. You can also post on Facebook or Twitter. The show is at OST Talk, and I'm at Celeste Headley. For today, that's On Second Thought from GPB News. Have a great day.